5 weeks talking about common myths that are that it seems to me anyway are pretty common and recurring within the community. And tonight we're going to focus on myths that are associated with the life cycle. We all have the opportunity, both in good times and bad times, to participate in events that are halachic, rituals, traditions that are associated with various times throughout our lives. And there are many possible points that we could focus on and reflect upon, but I just tried to select a few that stick out in my mind. Now, before we begin, I just want to mention some general disclaimers. I was excited about the topic, but when I sat down and I started to put it all together, I was a little concerned that we all walk away with the proper perspective on things. So I just want to begin with several general disclaimers. First of all, the presentations this evening are not intended to be extensive and comprehensive in any way, which I'm sure you can imagine. If I remember correctly, I'm going to present nine myths tonight. And so if I'm not going to keep you more than 45 minutes or maybe an hour, but certainly not more than that, so you could do the math, we're not going to be spending more than several minutes on each myth. So please do not walk away think that we've discussed everything that we possibly could about any of these issues. I'm also concerned that our learning together and not generate any skepticism or distrust in general about halacha, about tradition, about why we do things, how we do things. In fact, in general, I think that we are a well-educated muni, and we know what we're doing and why we're doing it. But there are, you know, always things that we could learn. Given that tonight and in the subsequent lectures, we're going to be focusing on things which seems to me anyway, many of us sort of get stuck in these myths. So it's possible that we could walk away after an hour or so, you know, just with this very skewed view on halacha and minhag in general, and I don't want that to happen. Do not change what you are doing without further consultation. We're just discussing myths. Most of these actually have no what we call nafkaminas, meaning there are very few things that we're going to present that have any practical relevance. But if you think that it may, if you think that you've been doing something improperly, if you are concerned that maybe there's something that you always thought, which is not the case, and therefore you should adjust how you do things, when you do things. So by all means, you should certainly consult with a halachic authority. I'm just here to present you with myths that we have, which generally speaking, with perhaps one or two exceptions tonight, are about the why we do things, not necessarily how or what we do. Okay. The first myth that I hope to dispel this evening is that the ideal location for a bris is in shul. Okay? So, the earliest records of a bris that take place in the shul, based on the research that I've done, are in the 11th century. Now, that's a long time. So, this is certainly not a myth, if we had it, that evolved any time recently. For at least 1,000 years, people have been performing a bris mila in a bris. There are several reasons, a bris in a shul. There are several reasons as to why a bris should take place in a shul. And again, I'm sure there are many more than I'm going to present this evening, but in looking through various svarim, I found the following. Number one, it's the fulfillment of the pasuk, Vayichusu bris lifnei Hashem. And they forged a bris, a covenant, a treaty, lifnei Hashem, before God. And of course, we go to shul to be lifnei Hashem, so it's appropriate. Because of the special kedusha, the sanctity of the Beis HaKnesses, it's appropriate that we should do a bris in that particular location. There is a concept based on the pasuk Barov Am Hadras Melech, that when we do mitzvos, it's better when possible to do them in the presence of a large assembly of people. And so therefore, when you come together in a large place, a facility such as a shul, so certainly optimizes the ability to go ahead and fulfill the mitzvah of bris milah Barov Am Hadras Melech. There's a concept of tircha de tzibura, meaning people are in shul anyway, so it's not going to be inconvenient to have people come to shul, because after all, people are in shul anyway. And another reason I saw it brought down is so there will be a separation between the genders, which is more fitting for the special visitor who comes to every bris, Eliyahu HaNavi. He'll be more happier if he sees the men and women as separate. So therefore, some say that's why the bris takes place in the shul. This way we don't have to tell anybody to separate. Why are there perhaps reasons why a bris should specifically take place in a house? So I've seen brought down. Well, just like we want to impress Eliyahu in shul, what is a chusidus to bring Eliyahu Hanavi to your home? What better way to bring him to your home than this? Now you may be thinking, God, but he visits us on Pesach anyway, so you'll have to wait to another week, and we're going to dispel that myth. There's no indication Eliyahu comes to a house on the Seder night, but he does come. But he does come to the bris, and so therefore we want to bring him to our homes. The blessing and the kedush of a bris should be mashpia on a home. So therefore we want to bring people to the home. Brought down an interesting story in the Sefer Shalmei Simcha. The Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was once asked whether a bris should take place in shul or in a sukkah. There was a baby that was born and they were davening and everybody was standing right near the sukkah. So he said, if we're here anyway, it makes sense to go to the sukkah. After all, we should go to the sukkah to do a simcha, to do a bris. Now, are there any reasons why bris should not take place in shul? So in the Sefer Nefesh HaRav, which is the first of a series of three Sfarim, which were written by Rav Schechter, based on teachings from Rav Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha. So he tells an interesting story over here, that one time he was traveling with the Rav to a wedding, and when the Rav realized that the wedding was taking place in a shul, he groaned a little bit, and he said, if I had known that the wedding would be in a shul, I would have come up with an excuse not to go, because really it's not right to have a chuppah in a Beis HaKnesses. The kavod that we are supposed to show in a Beis HaKnesses really precludes us from doing anything other than learning and davening. Rav Schechter himself says in parentheses over here that this point is a subject of great dispute among the poskim, but this was the position of Rav Soloveitchik. And so therefore he went on to say that the custom that we have to have a bris and shul, it's not because there's a kapeda that we are concerned that a bris specifically take place at shul. Rather, this is a kula, this is a leniency, because usually the bris takes place right after davening, and we don't want to be matriach. We saw this earlier. We want to inconvenience people, have to go ahead and go to a different building. And so therefore, there's a kula in order to accommodate the assembly of people that we say, okay, we're not going to make everybody leave. We're going to go ahead and proceed with the bris right here. But he says, if the milah is taking place later in the day, this is not a common scenario, but it does sometimes happen that a bris is later in the day. So he writes, min ha-nachon shelo la'asosa b'beis ha-knesetz. Really, it should not be done in shul. Ki az ein l'dun ha-katzar chirabim. Then you can't say that you're inconveniencing people, because after all, nobody was there anyway. So this is very interesting. The reality is that for most of us, if we have the opportunity in the future to go ahead and to make a bris, so we'll probably do it in the shul, and I wouldn't encourage you from doing otherwise. But it's nice to know that there's what to talk about over here. By the way, an example of somebody who had a bris in a house and turned out somewhat okay. My mom's here, so. Okay. So the fact is that the ideal location for a bris is not necessarily in shul. I can't say that it's not in shul, because as we saw, there are different opinions, but certainly not necessarily. Second myth. A husband should recite Brichas HaGomel on behalf of his wife. Now, this question is not limited to a situation where a woman gives birth to a child and perhaps would find herself in that situation. But in general, there are those who believe that a husband should recite Brichas HaGomel on behalf of his wife. Now, where does this come from? So there's a Gemara in Brachos, Daf Nun Dalet Amud Beis, which tells us the following. Amar Rabbi Yehuda Merav, Arba'a Tzrichan Lahodos. There are four categories of people that are required to offer formal praise of thanks, expressions of thanksgiving to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This would be in the form of a Karban Todah, when we had the Beis HaMikdash. And today we do so in the form of reciting a special bracha called Birchas HaGomel. The first one is Yardei Ayam, people who travel overseas and come to their destination safely. Holchei Midbarios, those people who travel through the deserts, which of course are all fraught with dangers and difficulties and challenge. Misha Yecholev in Isrape, a person who was sick and recovered from that which seemed like it was a life-threatening illness. And finally, Misha HaYechavish Bebeis Asurim Yatzah, a person who was held in captivity, a person who was imprisoned in a situation where their life, as is often as the case, was in peril and danger. So when a person has the opportunity to emerge from this great difficult challenge, so they would recite what's called the Birchas HaGomel. This is found in Shulchan Aruch, that there are four people who have to recite Brichas HaGomel. Again, Yod HaYom. Kishaolim imena v'hoch midbarios. Misha yechole. Misha yechavish b'veis asurim. And interestingly, the Mechaber tells us there's a simon for this. We say every day on a davening, v'chol ha-chayim yodu chasela, that all of the living should thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the word chayim could be broken down for chole, yisurim, yam, and midbar. For a person who's sick, a person who experienced suffering, a person who crossed the ocean or the desert. So that's very interesting. Okay, so here's where it gets a little interesting. If you look later on in Shulchan Aruch, it says the following. How is this bracha to be recited? Where should the bracha be recited? So the Mechaber writes, Tzorech levarich bracha zu b'fnei yud. The bracha should be said in the presence of a minyan. It sounds like it means a minyan. And those 10 could mean 10 people. But over here it sounds like a minyan. Why? Because it says, Trei menayu rabbanan. Two of them should be rabbis. The chsiv, as the pasuk says, and the pasuk is quoted in complete on the bottom from Tehillim, Parakuv Zayin, Yodu Hashem chastov v'niflosel v'nei adam, that we should thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for his chesed and for the wonders that he performs for people. V'romamu b'kel ha'am uv'moshav zekenim yahaluluhu. And we exalt God in the presence of an assembly of people and in the presence of zekenim. Doesn't mean elders, but of scholars, we praise him. And so therefore, the Mechaber goes on to teach us, v'nagu, the custom has evolved, levarech achar kriyas ha-Torah. Therefore, it has become customary to recite Brichas HaGomel after Kriyas HaTorah, or perhaps during Kriyas HaTorah, v'fisha yesha masara, because already you have a minyan present, and it's appropriate in the presence of the Sefer Torah, in the zchus of the Torah, so we go ahead and recite Brichas HaGomel there. The Mechaber goes on to say that if you did so at a different time, that's also okay, but it's best to go ahead and do it in that setting. Now, this is not the only picture that I could find online, but of course, this is a pretty typical scene where you see lots of men around the Sefer Torah at the time of Kriyas HaTorah. So based on this, some thought that, well, perhaps it's not proper for women to come and to stand up in shul at the time of Kriyas HaTorah and Ben Shkomel. So Beis Yosef says, Yesh Lema, we should consider for a moment, Amasha Noagim Ktsas Anoshim. I've seen some men, when their wives give birth, so they stand up and they bench gomel. So he says, after discussing for a little bit, I think the bottom line is, since everybody agrees, the husband in this case is not required to recite gomel, lo yivarech, he shouldn't, then birech gorenbo, if he does, we should reprimand him, because maybe for him to recite the brachos gomel is a brachos vatala. After all, he did not experience any life-threatening situation. It was not he who experienced childbirth, and therefore he should not be the one reciting Brichas HaGomel. The Aruch HaShulchan, many years later, the Aruch HaShulchan was written a little over 100 years ago, so apparently the custom continues. And he also says that the fact that we find that some men recite the Brichas HaGomel on behalf of their wives, he says there's a basis for this. However, he says, Mikom HaKom Ein HaMinog Kein, this is not the proper minog. And over here we have from Vad Yosef and the Tshuva Sichah V'Das, that he says, I don't think this is right. Amashinagu anashim shalol levarich kagomel. That is, minhag is evolved that women do not recite brichas kagomel. Nirashu minhag pato. So it would seem that this is a mistaken custom. V'mipnei shetzricha levarich b'pnei asara. V'shnayim et tamid echachamim. If the reason you're saying to do this is because it says we do it in the presence of a minion, v'ein zeh kvuda, and it's not considered to be proper for a woman to go ahead and recite brichas kagomel right there in the bima. V'chitam zeh yaspit lepotra michuyuva. Is this a sufficient reason to exempt her from an obligation? She can stand in the Ezras Nashim and recite it there, and everybody will hear and recite Amen. And so therefore, it says Ravad Yosef, I think that it's proper that should we reinstate the original tradition, the custom, the halach, the way it should be, that if a woman is in a situation where she needs to recite Brichas HaGomel, she should do it herself. V'chein kasav Rav Achida, B'Birkei Yosef, and he quotes other poskim as well. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, from the Sefer I quoted earlier, Shalmei Simcha, so he says, the bottom line is we see that there are different customs. There are certain places where it's done one way, certain places done the other way, and you should respect the local custom. We have a lot of people here from our shul, others who are not. The custom in our shul is that if a woman wants to recite Brichas HaGomel, all she does is let someone know, and the Gabbai pauses, and she recites Brichas HaGomel from the Ezras Nashim, and everybody recites Amen afterwards. So the fact is that a husband should not, again, sorry to let you down, but I'm a softie when it comes to these things, not necessarily recite Brichas HaGomel on behalf of his wife, as we saw, there were those who thought that that was proper, but it would seem that the prevalent custom seems to be, at least in our circles, that in fact a woman would recite Birch Zagomel on her own behalf. The next myth, a child should fast 3 fasts prior to reaching the age of Bar Bat Mitzvah. Any hear this one? We've all heard this. Okay, so what's going on here? The Shulchan Aruch writes in Siman Tuf Kuf Nun, Hakol Chayovim Lis'anos Arbat Somos Halolu. When it comes to the 4 fasts, these 4 fasts, what are these 4 fasts? So he's referring to the 4 fast days that are associated with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. We're not talking about Yom Kippur, we're not talking about Tanis Esther. So that leaves us with Tisha B'Av, Shavuos B'Tammuz, Asar B'Teves, and Tzom Gedalia. Everyone should participate in these. V'asa Lifrotz Geder. And it's prohibited for a person to say, nah, I'm not interested. I'm not going to participate in this public fast. Everybody should participate in a public fast day. Says the Bir Halacha, that's the more extensive commentary, the Mishnah Berurah, the Chafetz Chaim writes over there, what do we mean when we say everyone? He says we mean adults. So that would mean Tinokes Bas Yud Beishanim. That would mean a girl once she reaches the age of 12. V'tinok Ben Yud Gimel Shanav Yom Echad would mean a boy when he reaches the age of 13. At that point, velo kodim lekein, and not beforehand. Okay, what about chinuch? Isn't there a concept of chinuch? Don't we always train our children in mitzvos? We try to get them ready to do mitzvos so that when they are of age, so they're ready to go. They're off and running. So that's why we buy lulav for a child when the child's young. We put a tzitzis on a child. So from the Sefer Halicho Shlomo, which is a collection of Piskei Halacha and commentaries on the Halacha from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, he says as follows. The Av Shechayavim over here, even though it's true that Medina, we have to educate our children when it comes to mitzvos, mikomakom gam oz lo yachu milisa b'tzarayim. So that would mean that when it comes to a fast day, maybe when your child is old enough, not to a 3-year-old, child reaches an age, 7, 8, 9, so you can say, you know what, maybe you'll skip breakfast. We'll have breakfast a little later today. You know, or maybe even skip lunch. But once you hit the afternoon already, so we shouldn't impose ourselves on a child in that way. And he says, Va'af b'yom ha-kippurim. And even when it comes to Yom Kippur, ha-samach li-yom ha-giyim le-mitzvos, lo yashlimu atanis, we should not allow our children to go ahead and finish the entire day. El-adinam kechol tin katan shigiyah le-chinuch. Rather, should be like every other katan, even though they're getting very close to age. And here on the footnote on the bottom, which is blown up for you over here, he writes as this. In note 67, Velo sphere leilu rabbeinu klal masha nafutz bekama mekomos shakotan misane o mashlim begimal tzomos asmuchum liyom abar mitzvah. It says over here that Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach completely rejected this notion that people said that a child should fast for 3 days before the bar, 3 fasts before the bar mitzvah. Va'af l'misha nagu kein bebeis avosav horish lo yisane. Says Reb Shlomo Zalman, even if this was your custom, he would tell people, don't do it. He said, this is not a real minhag. It probably evolved because parents or maybe kids themselves wanted to sort of test themselves and see if they were ready. The child's very anxious. Soon I'm going to be a bar mitzvah. So they don't know if they're ready. After all, we know the kids always think, I can't do it, I can't do it. And then they go ahead and they say, oh, that wasn't so bad. But he said, lahachzik, excuse me, there's no reason why we should be machzik this as a minhag. It has to be this way. And he says, it's enough that we should go ahead and we should train our children to fast a few hours. We don't have to add more than that. And certainly when it comes to something like this, for which there is no makar. So, a lot of the things I'm going to present tonight, this is the first one, we're going to make statements like there is no makar. So at the end of the day, it's much easier to say, here is a makar, than to say, here there is no makar, right? There's an expression that poskim use, found in the Gemara, if I'm not mistaken, lo ra'inu einu raya, right? The fact that you haven't seen something doesn't disprove it as being a possibility. But when we find in Sfarim like this, you know, a statement from the great Gaon of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach that this is something which has no makar, so we could trust him, at least for the purpose of this discussion, that it has no makar. Halacha l'maaseh, if a child comes over to me next week and he says, Rabbi, you know, my bar mitzvah is in a few months. Should I fast Tanis Esther? I would not discourage him from doing so. Remember that many poskim in the past had reservations of children and even adults fasting because people were not as necessary as well-nourished as we are in general. And a fast would be not just an imposition, but could sometimes really compromise one's health. And the halacha is very clear that when it comes to a chola is not required to fast ever. And we were, you know, therefore, you know, there was perhaps a little, you know, concern about having people fast unnecessarily. Today, where most people, nothing's going to happen, even children when they're older, if they fast. So if a child is inclined to do so, fine. But the fact of the matter is, the kids really get very excited about this. That's been my impression. So I wouldn't tell anybody you have to. I wouldn't encourage anyone to do so, but I don't think there's any great harm necessarily. This has been very common in our communities that kids fast before the bar mitzvah. But the fact of the matter is that a child need not or should not refast prior to the reaching out the age of bar mitzvah. But here I didn't even say necessarily. I could say this without qualification. There doesn't seem to be any mucker for this idea. Next myth. A boy should begin wearing tefillin 30 days before his bar mitzvah. You ever hear that one? So, there is a Braisa, which is found in Masech HaSukkah Daf Mem Beis, which says, Tanu Rabbanan, a rabbi's taught, Katan HaYodei L'Naneya Chayei B'Lulav. Once a child reaches the age where he can properly hold and shake a lulav in the way that it should be, so he should get a lulav. L'Sateif, once he knows how to put on a talus, tzitzis properly, Chayei B'Tzitzis. At that point, he's required to wear tzitzis. Lishmor Tefillin, once he's old enough to guard, literally to guard, to watch Tefillin, Aviv Lokeach Lo Tefillin, so then, his father should purchase for him a pair of tefillin. Rashi says, what does it mean? Lishmar? Shelo yichnos behen leveis hakise. To know that you don't take tefillin into a bathroom. You don't take tefillin into a bathroom. Maybe obvious to adults, but to a little child, imagine a child 6, 7, 8 years old, wearing a tzitzis. It's no big deal if he goes with the tzitzis into the bathroom. But tefillin, you shouldn't take it to a bathroom. So a child should be old enough. The Shulchan Aruch says, katan ayodeh lishmar tefillin betahara. A child who's old enough, who knows how to preserve the sanctity, the purity that one should maintain when handling tefillin, namely that he doesn't sleep in them and he doesn't pass gas in them. At that point, chayav adam liknos lo tefillin lechancho. At that point, his father should buy him tefillin and begin to be mechanechim in this mitzvah. The Ramah says, and we generally follow the piskei halacha of the Ramah, the Ashkenazim, v'yoshomim dehai katan dafke shuhu ben yud gimel shana v'yom echad. Unbelievable, says the Ramah. When it says katan, it's not like you're thinking a 7, 8, 9-year-old. No. The katan means when he's already reached the age of bar mitzvah. Just because you're bar mitzvah doesn't mean you're old enough to wear tefillin. But once a child reaches the age of bar mitzvah, at that point, if he's ready, so okay, his father should buy him tefillin. V'chein nagu v'ein l'shanos. Says the Ramah, this is the custom, and we should not deviate from this. What does it mean we shouldn't deviate? So it says the Mishnah Berurah, v'achshav nagu l'aniach beiz or gimel chadashim kodim azman. So the Magen Avraham says, okay. So even though technically you really shouldn't do too much before the 13th birthday, but okay, you want to do 2, 3 months beforehand. The Aruch HaShulchan says the minhag is 1 month. You see from here very clearly at your bar mitzvah, 2 months, 3 months, 1 month. So why is this relevant? For the most part, it's not, in the sense that most people really do start putting on tefillin around 30 days beforehand. And as we see, assuming the child is mature enough to handle the tefillin properly, no great harm. However, there are times where, I mean, again, people should always ask questions. I don't mind when people ask these questions, but they get all worked up because the dates don't work, because 30 days beforehand is a Sunday and they want to do something at school, or 30 days beforehand is a Tuesday and want to do something on a Sunday, or the grandparents are going to be away, and, you know, and they're all nervous, you know, and people wouldn't think twice about pushing off a bar mitzvah for 2, 3 weeks or months, if need be, but, hey, the day to put on tefillin, so, you know, the fact of the matter is, a boy may begin wearing tefillin 30 days before his bar mitzvah. He may. He could begin 40 days, and he can begin also 20 days. My son, his bar mitzvah came out about a month after Yom Kippur, a little later than that. But the custom of my family is we don't wear tefillin during Sukkot. So when you do the math, it comes out that he was going to like lose. He was going to lose like a week or so, you know, of that practice. Plus, I thought it would be really nice if he would be able to put on his tefillin for the first time the day after Yom Kippur. So even though the numbers didn't work out just well, I checked with my Rebbe, and he said that was fine. Nice. So my son put on his tefillin for the first time the day after Yom Kippur, which was a little more than 30 days before his bar mitzvah, but in the end, it came out to about 30 days for the reason I mentioned. Next myth. Oh, this is one of my favorite ones. A bride and groom should not see each other for 7 days before the wedding. Ever hear this one? Okay. So, here's a nice couple, really happy to get married, and all of a sudden we say, that's it. 7 days beforehand, you have to separate. Shkia, that's it. Say your final goodbyes. No more talking. People had different minhagim. We talk on the phone. We send letters to each other, email, text. Some people say, no, we don't do that. Do you FaceTime? All these new questions that come up today. But the bottom line is, what is the source for this idea? What is the source for this idea that couples don't see each other before their wedding? So if you look in the Gemara, you'll find no source. If you look in the Rishonim, you'll find no source. If you look in Shulchan Aruch, you'll find no source. If you look, in 1994, there was a book published called The Book of Chabad Lubavitch Customs, and it says for a week before their wedding, the bride and groom should refrain from meeting, even by day. A little later, in the year 2002, the Laws of Nida, published by Rabbi Binyamin Forst, a posek who lives in Far Rockaway, he writes, the custom is developed that a chassan and kahal do not see each other during the week preceding the wedding. Rabbi Forst also writes, although this custom is not halacha, and has no early source in the poskim, it is a good custom, because it gives the chassan and kahal an opportunity to be alone, and to reflect upon the profound changes that are about to take place in their lives. That's true. Sometimes, actually, it happens the opposite effect. Sometimes it causes a lot of unnecessary tension, particularly if there are things that need to get done. I remember on more than one occasion, the chassan and kahal forgot to get their marriage license beforehand, and they call up and wonder if they could do shtick at the wedding, that they'll take care of their marriage license afterwards. So one's a halacha, one's not. There's no halacha that a chassan and kahal can't see each other before the wedding. There is a halacha that rabbi is not allowed to officiate at a wedding if the chassan and kahal don't have a marriage license. That's against civil law. So one's a halacha psuka, the other one isn't. So I would tell them they should go. And if they don't want to see each other for long, okay, so they can go in and out, get the marriage license, and then leave. Where does this really become relevant today? So this really becomes relevant when it comes to taking pictures before the wedding. This has become a very important question. It's not a new question, but over the past several years, 10 years or so, but maybe even more so over the last 5 years, it has been common in many circles. I'm not sure that this is common in the more right-wing community. I'm not sure. But certainly within the modern Orthodox community, it's become, I also don't know if it's the norm yet, but it is becoming more and more the norm that a chassan and kahal will take pictures before their chuppah. That means, if they would ask me, I would recommend they take pictures together with everyone else, members of the family, so they could save time later. The more personal pictures that the bride and groom take as they're standing, holding each other's hands, just the two of them, so that already they can wait till after the chuppah, and while everybody's eating their soup, no great harm. But if you're going to go ahead and say that they can't take any pictures beforehand, unless you're going to, what's that called, Photoshop them afterwards, that could sometimes mean half hour, 45 minutes delay before they come out. That is considered a tircha de tzibura, when you're going to cause people to have to wait. And it could also very often mean those who are paying for the wedding to have to incur additional costs, overtime costs. So the net effect of this chumrah, it's not even a chumrah, but of this minag ta'us, the least way it's being applied over here, is great, and it's really difficult to justify. Sometimes you find that a chassan kahal, they want to do it because just for sentimental reasons. You know, there's something nice and romantic about seeing each other for the first time at the Badekin. And it's a great life lesson for the chassan kahal. And that is, you're right, it is. It does have some nice meaning and sentimental value. But when you have 300, 400, 500 people waiting in the other room, and someone's going to have to pay money, you know, in order to, so it's okay. Your wedding will still be beautiful and you'll have a long, happy life together, but you could forego this particular sentimental moment. So the fact of the matter is that a bride and groom may see each other for 7 days before the wedding. Okay, the next myth. At least one Sheva Rachos meal should be arranged for each day during the week following a wedding. My wife didn't come tonight, which is probably good. Again, this is a big one for me. Now, the Shulchan Aruch, forgive me, it's a little small, I apologize. The Shulchan Aruch does write, based on a Gemara and Ksuvos, mitzvah l'sameach chasen v'kala. There is a mitzvah to be m'sameach chasen v'kala, which means that we should try to add to their joy, and we should try to do things to make them happy, and not just say mazel tov, and give them an envelope, but we should do things that really try to show them how happy we are for them. And this is a mitzvah. It's actually a great mitzvah. The Gemara tells us special things about one who is able to be Mesameach Chasam Nekala. Nevertheless, if we look in earlier sources, it is clear that it was not common at all for there to be 7 days of feasting. It's true that for a first marriage, so there's a concept that when you have a meal in which you have a minyan and panim chadashos, and it's during the 7 days, the Sheva Yemei Hamishteh, so then we can recite what we call the Sheva Brachos, but that we're obligated to go ahead and create a meal of Sheva Brachos. We don't find this. The Maril, it's a very early source, about 1,000 years old. So he writes that the custom over there is that sometimes they would have Sheva Brachos on Shabbos. Sometimes they would have Sheva Brachos on Shabbos. The Beis Yosef seems to quote perhaps the earliest source for the idea of Sheva Brachos happening throughout the week, and that's from a tshuva, the Rashba. The Rashba is talking about there's an idea that people should not get married on Yom Tif. So people don't get married on Yom Tif. So he talks about whether you get married before Yom Tif and Sheva Brachos leading into Yom Tif. That's a problem. And the answer is it's not a problem. And the Rashba writes over here, it's underlined, Afal Pisha Smechim Besudas Anisuin Kol Shiva. So this seems to be a reference to this idea that people used to have meals throughout the week. But certainly it's not a halacha psuka that you will not find anywhere in the Gemara, anywhere in Shulchan Aruch, which says this is something that is required. The Aruch HaShulchan says, Etzleinu Enosim Kol Shiva Simei HaMishra Sudas Ki Yadua. We don't do this, says Aruch HaShulchan. Again, I told you beforehand, a little more than 100 years ago. Curious. A lot of people in the room, different ages, but raise your hand if when you got married, you had Sheva Brachos for every day during the week. Okay, so it looks to me like at least half, the hands are not up. Now, if I would ask a room full of people who are 25 or younger, so everybody would, and if they weren't, they would be embarrassed to raise their hand. Because Nebuch, you're a person who only had 6 days. But this is a new concept. Listen to this. This is a quote in the Sefer Meged Givos Olam, Rav Michal Shurkin, who was a Talmud of the Rav, Zochrono Lebracha. He writes, Zochisi l'sheves besuda sheva brachos b'chitzas ha'gon b'shalom ha'zaman Orbach. I was once zoche, I saw this quoted in another place, it was in 1992 apparently. I was once zoche to sit at a sheva brachos of b'shalom ha'zaman. U'betoch devarav, hu nenach. And while we were talking, he was kvetching. What's going on today? People make Sheva Brachos every day. He quoted, the Chassam Sofer writes, Shepam achas osa echod su de Sheva Brachos per Shabbos, velozal of kol medina. One time somebody had the chutzpah to make Sheva Brachos on Shabbos, and everybody in the town started yelling at him, ah, chutzpah, going ahead and making Sheva Brachos, we already went to your wedding, enough, leave us alone. Chassam Sofer says, one time somebody had the chutzpah to do this, and everybody got all upset. And we find as well in the Aruch HaShulchan, She'ein anu no'al maso su de Sheva Brachos b'chol yom, I quoted that already. So, you wouldn't say that just because you're a great tzaddik like Shlomo Zalman Orbach, so you say, well, it's the nice thing, it's the right thing. He was kvetching. Why are people doing this? What's his concern? So there's an interesting, right. There's an interesting article online on the OU website from Rabbi Dr. Avi Zivotofsky. And he writes, he quotes the Sovas Machos, who's cited in the Sefer and assumed the Kil Chasam, and he says as follows, if it appears that organizing daily Sheva Brachos is a burden on the Chasam Nekala, they should not conduct themselves in a way that it does not become burdensome to them. If having daily meals is affordable, both financially and emotionally, and it does not present any undue hardships to the couple, it is a commendable custom. If it is not, then it is unnecessary. Now, the reality is, I don't have any solutions here, and I'm not really standing before you and suggesting that we dramatically, change the way we do things from now on. You are hereby informed that if you get married, you should expect no more than one Sheva Brachos. But at the same time, I have seen repeatedly situations where people are panicking because they have one day in the middle and it's not filled, and Nebuch, what's going to be? Maybe it's a bad sign, it's a bad omen that something's wrong with them because there's going to be something very deficient over here. Let's not rewrite history. It was not until very recently, it seems, that people started making Sheva Brachos every day. We have as recently as 25 years ago, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach kvetching about the fact that Klal Yisrael seems to feel the need to make Sheva Brachos every day, which is expensive. Now, I will say over here, it says, if it's affordable. So obviously, this means on a case-by-case basis. But when you take a step back, for all of Klal Yisrael, it is a major it's a major expense. And again, these are one of the things that, you know, I don't have any solutions. I'm not even sure it's a problem necessarily that I'm looking to solve. I'm not looking to solve any problems over here. It happens to be a beautiful thing, and this should be our biggest problem. Everybody should just get married and be happy. I'll make many shevrachos. Good. But again, if you ever find yourself in a situation where you're either yourself or perhaps trying to, your shoulder that your friend is crying on and complaining about the fact that that they're missing a night or two, so you could reassure them that they're in good company with the people in Pressburg. When the Chassam Sofer said that one person once had the chutzpah to go ahead to make a Shev Brachos on Shabbos, and everybody yelled at him. So the fact is that it is not required to arrange for Shev Brachos meals each day during the week following a wedding. Myth. One with the tattoo may not be buried in a Jewish cemetery. This is very serious. This is a serious one, as you'll see when we discuss this, but it's serious because this particular myth has led to a lot of pain. A lot of pain for people who had tattoos and loved ones of people who had tattoos based on this great mistake. I didn't want to include it in the presentation over here, but if you look online, you'd see many celebrities who get involved in the Kabbalah Center in Beverly Hills who start having their tattoos removed because they decide that, you know, they get really turned on to Judaism. I don't know, they're probably not Jews, but they decide they want to do things the right way. And this is the halacha that they learn, that a Jew, you can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery if you have a tattoo. So again, you know, this is, but it's not true. So what's going on over here? It's absolutely true that tattoos are bad. It's a pasuk in the Torah in Parshas Kedoshim, v'seret lenefesh lo sitnu b'vsarchem, uksovas kaka lo sitnu b'chem ani Hashem. What does that mean, ksovas kaka? So it says, Raman Hilchas Avodos Kachavim, ksovas kaka mura b'torah, hu sirtut al b'saro. This means literally scraping or cutting one's skin, v'imali mokom asrita kachol diyo o shar tzivonim, harashum haroshmim, that you fill in this hole with some type of dye or ink, which colors the skin. This was common practice in ancient times among people who were involved in different forms of idol worship, pagan worship. This is what they did. And therefore, the Rambam incorporates this halacha within the laws of Avodas Kochavim. To be clear, today, most people who have tattoos are not doing so as a form of idol worship. This is just something which is culturally appealing to certain people. And there are lots of people who have tattoos. It's a very big industry, a very big business. There's no question about it. One is not permitted to have a tattoo. 7 months ago, I talked about certain situations where a person may require a tattoo for either cosmetic purposes, medical purposes. Also, it's important to just reflect as we find ourselves really at the end of an era. There are still people walking around with numbers on their arms, but they are, of course, much fewer than they once were. And within the next decade or so it'll be, you know, be something only of pictures. But there were poskim who were asked after the war by people who survived concentration camps, should they have these tattoos removed? And if I'm not mistaken, unanimously, poskim said you should not have it removed, and to the contrary, it was a sign of Gvur, the survival of the Jewish people. So there are situations where people have either they've been forced or they're required because of circumstances to have tattoos. Also, the question comes up today about having a certain makeup, permanent makeups that they have, which is not necessarily really tattoo. So these are questions. But to have a tattoo on your arm or your leg or another part of your body, this is not something that Jews do. Now, in the Jerusalem Post in 2003, the following in an article entitled In the Flesh, True! In past generations, rabbis responded to the biblical injunction by denying the tattooed atara, a purification, the traditional cleansing and preparation of a Jewish body for burial. However, in today's predominantly secular society, where tattoos are usually acquired for decorative and not idolatrous reasons, that sanction has been unofficially lifted. And I can tell you there is absolutely no evidence of this whatsoever. Not that it's been lifted, but that it ever existed. I can't tell you that there was never once a Chevra Kadisha anywhere on planet Earth that said, we won't take a body that has a tattoo. But there's certainly no makkah for this. It would not be justified. So where does such a myth begin? This is a fascinating one to consider because it is so prevalent and it's so painful. A lot of people. So where does this myth begin? I mean, there are people who have tattoos. They're very likely there are people in the shul who have tattoos. I know there are people in the shul who have tattoos. In their past life, they had tattoos. They wouldn't do it again. They haven't had them removed. It's not unheard of. So for a person to walk around with this fear that they won't be able to be buried in a Jewish cemetery, so this is where it gets really very upsetting. So number one, there's an association we've already seen between tattoos and idolatry, which create the impression that tattoos are uniquely abhorrent. Now, I'm not going to stand before you and tell you that there's anything which is not abhorrent about tattoo, but it's really no different than any other issur that a person would do. One could argue, well, this is something which is engraved on their body, as opposed to a person who once ate chametz on Pesach. You know that when the person passes away, it's not there as an eternal sign on their body. But okay, traditionally burial societies would maintain separate sections for different types of people, and that exists to this very day. There are certain cemeteries that have certain sections which will only allow people who conform to a certain way of living when they're alive. And I know of certain people who have been called periodically every 5-10 years from the burial society to make sure that they are still following the rules. And it's their right. You know, just like you could decide who you want to have your house, you could decide who you want to be buried in your section of the cemetery. Additionally, there were certain communities which denied cremated individuals their right to Jewish burial. To my knowledge, this is the only situation where a person would be denied burial in a Jewish cemetery. And this was seen at a time of being a way of deterring cremation, which is something which is a very terrible thing from our perspective for a Jew to do. And it could be that what evolved from all this sort of led to the promulgation of this myth that, well, you know, tattoos are a really bad thing, and so therefore, just like the people who cremated, so too. But it's not true. It's not true. And ironically, this is hard to read. There are reports of those who had tattoos and therefore chose to be cremated rather than be buried in a non-Jewish cemetery, Juan al-Islam. But they were so misinformed that they didn't realize that the tattoo would have not been a problem. But certain cemeteries do have a rule that they will not bury the ashes of a person who's been cremated. So the reality is that this is a myth, and the fact is that one with a tattoo may in fact be buried in a Jewish cemetery. There's a myth that food may not be used once it has been removed from a house of mourning. Now, this is a different myth than some of the other ones we've seen, because there is a basis for this. There is a basis, but I'm going to tell you why this one is particularly near and dear to me. This is something that I want to try to publicly address. It is found in the Hagos of Rabbi Akiva Eiger in Shulchan Aruch Yerodei Simin Shin Ayin Vav. Noagin shelo likach davar katan v'gadol mi beis ovel. Kol meshach shiv yimei avelus mishum sheruach hatuma shoresham kol shiva. Akiva Eiger says it has become customary not to remove anything from a beis ovel. Not talking about food, but to remove anything. A chair, a book, anything from beis ovel for the entire 7 days, because the ruach tuma, because there is some impure spirit which is found in the Beis Ovel for 7 days. So this is obviously a mystical concept. It's not a halachic concept. This is not something which is derived from sources which are much earlier than this. Rabbi Akiva Eiger lived in the 19th century. But this is a custom which is found already in a source. Now, some later said that this doesn't apply to food, dafka. Others say that this only applies to taking things from the actual room in which the nifta died, often today. More often than not, people do not die in the house at all. When a person dies in the house, so there are actually other halachos that apply. So it could be that this whole kepeda was only in that situation. Others say that there is no basis for this custom whatsoever, and there are no restrictions at all. Of particular concern, and this is not only to me, but it is of concern to me, when there is an abundance of food, which we very often find today. A lot of people, Baruch Hashem, people bring food and they buy food and they send food. And as much as people try, and we do try, and we usually succeed to coordinate to make sure that you have Monday and you have Tuesday and you have Wednesday. But usually there is just too much food. Sometimes there's so much food that there's no place to store it in the house. So they have to start bringing it to the neighbors and giving it away. And I've seen people who have this idea and they're like, no. Once it comes in the house, it doesn't leave. And if it's going to leave, it's going to leave in the garbage. Comes along, Rav Chaim Kanievsky in the Sefer Alichos Chaim. This is not written by Rav Chaim, but this Piskei Halacha, which were based on things that he taught. So in a footnote here, it says the following.
that Rav Shlomo Kluger, Rav Vosner was asked, "Bizmanich mavelim rachman al islam aviyim anashim ochel beis avel v'nisha habayocha."
This is the question. We have at the time of Nicham Avelim, people bring a lot of food, and there's a lot of food left over. Can you give the food to somebody else? Or do you have to throw out the food, like we saw from Rabbi Akiva Eger, that you can't take anything out of the Beis Avel? Like Rabbi Akiva Eger said, for the 7 days. He says, it's obvious that this whole thing is only a minhag. But the iser of batashchis, of wasting food, is something which is an iser mefureshes b'Torah. That's a Torah prohibition. We would not say that a minhag, which again seems to have a very, very, we'll say a very flimsy source, not that Rabbi Akiva Eger is flimsy, but in other words, we can't trace this back to very early sources, and it's not even clear that Rabbi Akiva Eger would have been talking about food at all, or a Beis Avel where the person didn't die in the house. Okay, but so we would not say that that should override an issa b'tashchis. Therefore, there's nothing wrong whatsoever with giving it to other people. There are people who are still going to be spooked out and say, oh, I'm not going to take food from Beis Avel. So if nobody wants to take it, should give it to share it a plate. But they'll take it and they'll make sure that the food doesn't get wasted, and people who need it will take it. I don't remember ever being offered food from Beis Avel, but if anybody would ever offer me, I wouldn't turn it down. There's no reason to turn it down. There's no problem. There's no iser. By the way, even Rabbi Akiva Eger, if you go back to that mukar, he didn't say that you're not permitted to eat food that came from Beis Avel. He just says the minhag not to take things out of the house during Shiva. But that, you know, it could be that if it's stored in the house or put in the refrigerator, then you know, even those who would be very concerned, you know, about this this custom would have nothing to be concerned about. So the fact is that food may be used once it has been removed from a house of mourning. Here's my last myth, if you're counting. So this is number 9. A man should receive an aliyah after he completes the observance of Shiva. Cal, do you ever hear that one?
Yes.
You have. Now, again, this one's going to hurt, especially if you're a gabbai. Okay. Now, this comes straight from the gabbai's handbook. Okay? This is the order of precedence for receiving an aliyah. Okay? If there are any gabbaim in the room, maybe I would bring them up right now and test them. But it's a long list, and everybody, you know, gabbai has a book and he has a cheat sheet, and there's no situation where you'd ever have all these people together in a room at the same time. But here is the order, the way that if you gather from all the sources, here it is according to Minhag Ashkenaz. The chassan on the day of his wedding comes first. So if you have a chassan on the day of his wedding at shul, he gets an aliyah before anybody else. Number 2, chassan on the Shabbos immediately preceding his wedding, that's according to Minhag Ashkenaz. If you have Minhag Sfard, so actually the Shabbos following the wedding is considered to be a greater kavod. One who became a bar mitzvah that week would be number 3 on the list. A new father on the first Shabbos that his wife comes to shul. That's the way it's brought down in the poskim. Chassan on the first Shabbos after his wedding. One who was observing a yard site for a parent on that day. New father on the Shabbos preceding the bris. One who was observing a yard site for a parent in the coming week. About Tokay and about Musaf on Rosh Hashanah. A mole and a sandik on the day of a bris. One who needs to recite Brichas HaGomel, going back to what we saw earlier, and one who is preparing to go on a long journey where one has just returned from a long journey. So this is all you'll find in the Gabbai's handbook. If anybody else comes home and he says, I deserve to have an aliyah because I just got a new job. So if you're a nice Gabbai, you'll say, by all means, I'm happy to give you an aliyah. Why not? After all, we give aliyahs to people all the time and they don't meet this criteria. But when it comes to the idea that somebody is sort of due an aliyah, that we would go out of our way to give him one, maybe he should take precedence over anywhere else. This is all I was able to find. I have found to date, and I've been looking for many years, no source whatsoever for the notion, for this idea, that a person is to get an aliyah when he gets up from Shiva. Have I ever instructed the Gabbayim here, or would I ever, don't give an aliyah to a person when he gets up from Shiva? No, because there's nothing wrong with it. I once heard a very nice explanation. I feel a little weird giving an explanation for something that's probably not true. But I do remember that in one of my first years here in the shul, there was a question that came up. Because there was one of these people, I don't remember who, and somebody got it from Shiva. And one gabbai argued with me, respectfully, that the guy who's got it from Shiva was like all the way on the top of the list. And I remember the reason he gave. So I remember at the time telling him, I never heard of this before at all.
So I'm always happy to learn from my Gaboyim. I remember saying, this is one of my first years here, I never heard of this. He says, yeah, let me tell you why. He says, because for the 7 days of Avelos, an Avel is not permitted to learn. He's not permitted to learn Torah, which is why during Shiva we wouldn't give an Avel and Aliyah. Because part of getting Aliyah means that you read from the Torah, and an Avel is not permitted to engage in the study of Torah. And so therefore, when he goes ahead and he sort of re-enters the world after the Shiva, so we mark that occasion by giving Aliyah. That's a beautiful explanation for a minute that doesn't exist. It's very nice. I was very touched by it, so touched that I remember it many years later. But I will say, and I've asked other people as well, I've asked other rabbis, I've asked other Gaboyim, so we'll leave you to the challenge. If anybody could find any source for this, I will be able to begin next week's shiur with that, but I don't think you'll find one. So this, like I said, this was a big one because this is one of the things that everybody knows. You get up from the Shiva, you get an Aliyah. And again, I see it happen all the time, and that's okay. That's okay. I mean, nobody should ever be in Shiva, but when it happens, a person comes back to shul giving Aliyah, not a problem. But this is, the fact of the matter is that there is no evidence that a man should receive an Aliyah after he completes the observance of Shiva. Next week, we will talk, because right isn't always right, about ritual myths. I thank you very much for joining us.